now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix. Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Scott Torrance. Scott Torrance is a remote viewer who has had a number of ET encounters, and he also has an interesting Sasquatch / Yowie story, because in Australia, a lot of people refer to the Sasquatch here as the Yowie. And I met Scott at the Byron Bay UFO conference, the Close Encounters conference last year, and we had an interesting chat, and I said to myself, and Kylie and I talked about this, and we got to get this guy on the show because, you know, his information is so spot on. So, you know, we thought it was a good time to bring about the beginning of this video portion of our Cosmic Switchboard Show by having someone come on as a remote viewer, you know, because that's where the twain meets, the visual, the remote viewing, and all that stuff. So, and we'll have all of Scott's website information on the Cosmic Switchboard website, as well as on our dedicated YouTube channel. So without any further ado, Scott Torrance, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here with you. It was always great to have met you at the conference, and now it's going to be great to talk with you again.
Yes, and you're going to be one of the speakers at this year's Close Encounters conference. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. That'll be great. I'll present some insight into remote viewing and the technical side of it, its application for science. It's a very good form of technical clairvoyance, which is what it was founded on. So hopefully to expand a little bit. It is a very disciplined role, and a lot of people do use the term remote viewing without it really being in its true context. So I'd like to pay respect to the founders in their paradigm of it all, really. I'm a second generation viewer. I'm a civilian viewer that became aware of it back in 97. So we have a little bit more freedom. It's interesting to see it.
Yeah,
expand with.
Just a thought for the viewers. In case you're wondering, it's raining where you're at, right, Scott?
Yes, it is. It is. I'm in Byron. The first rain we've had in 3 months, and the plants are very happy.
Yeah. And so if you're wondering what that sound is in the background, it's the rainfall, and it's, you know, causing this background noise. So don't worry about that. And also, you know, if there's a momentary like lull in the transmission, so to speak, it's just the weather causing some issues. But anyhow, tell us a bit about yourself, Scott, and how you know, the journey that brought you up to this point, how you became a remote viewer.
I was a clairvoyant basically as a young child, since about the age of four. When I was about four and a half, I saw a news report on television that was about some children of war that were being flown out of Vietnam on a UNICEF mercy mission. And I've always had a good empathy with people my own age. And I saw immediately that these children were shot down by a missile. And I said that to my family. I said, oh, it's a great thing that they're all doing here, but they're all dead. And that was quite shocking to my family, who all just thought, oh, you know, a four-year-old shouldn't come out with that sort of thing. And back in the 70s, the news wasn't instantaneous as it is now. So it took about a week to come out, and then it was identified as that. So I learned to be quiet about it until I was about 12. My young teenage years involved a lot of lucid dreaming and out-of-body states while dreaming. It wasn't until I was about 21 that I realized that all my friends weren't doing that sort of stuff. So it is an involuntary thing if you're a natural. It comes and goes. And a number of premonitions kept me alive through my young years there. And by the time I reached my mid-20s, I was definitely looking into different areas of religions and science, and looking into physics and quantum physics and trying to get a better explanation for this. I wasn't religious in any way. I wasn't indoctrinated through Christianity or any other Buddhism or any other sort of form of religion, even though Buddhism is not a religion, it's a practice. In 1997, a documentary came out called The Real X-Files by Jim Schnabel in the States, produced by Channel 4 in the UK. And that was about the Stargate program, remote viewing program in the States with the original people, and featured Ingo Swann, who's the founder of the field. And I knew instantly that this was something that suited me. It was utilitarian in nature. It wasn't mystical. I liked the military approach of it, either worked or it didn't. So I contacted the production company in the UK and got a copy of the video. But apart from that, they were all intelligence personnel, professionals, yeah. You know, and they were very difficult people to contact. So I spent probably the next 3 years gradually getting little bits of feeds from the Munro Institute was very important, and Courtney Brown's Farsight Institute, and a number of other viewers that were releasing work, but it was quite minor at the time. Not like it is today, where you can go online and see videos and quite a lot of contact and publicity on it. So, yeah, that's the sort of the short story of it all. When you're a young guy and you're a clairvoyant and you're growing into your maturity, you can have experiences which are similar to moving into different rooms within your head. And each room is a different form of perception. So I had a fair bit of experience before this. But that being said, my interest in aliens and understanding ghosts as a natural part of that took many years to develop. You know, in the beginning, I was just as frightened as anyone else was of these sorts of things, and learning control and learning, you know, discipline is all a part of the maturity of clairvoyance. So clairvoyance also tends to be very open field, in the sense you may get information at any time on things that seem totally random, and it all has to be incorporated in later hindsight when you see, well, wow, that was actually the most important factor in something. So you learn to be very open-minded, and you try to be as disciplined as you can so that you don't delude yourself. It's your own maturity.
If you don't mind, could you share some of the instances in your past when premonitions helped kind of pull you out of a dodgy situation?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a competitive surfer in my 20s, and surfing is a liquid-cooled sport that you have very high cardiovascular endurance levels through. So where you'd normally run around on a field and get very hot and have to slow down, in surfing you can be liquid cooled by the ocean, and you can push, because fun is your main, you know, driver. You're not really chasing hundredths of a second or anything. My brothers are both Olympic swimmers, and they chase hundredths of a second. So that is very good for neurological activity. Your head runs on blood and oxygen, and to be able to pump a lot of it through there is important. So I think that had a big factor in it for sure. One of the strongest events was driving a car up to a roundabout near my hometown, and all of a sudden the picture of the road stopped. An image of a car windowsill scraping along the ground took over, and I came back after a few seconds to just a normal view of the road again, of the roundabout I was approaching. And it was very shocking, because it was the first involuntary, truly involuntary thought I'd had that took over my consciousness. And you know, I was concerned. I thought, wow, you know, is this a precursor to insanity or craziness or something like this? This is an uncontrolled thought, which was quite unique. But the problem was, if it was just a thought, it left me with sweaty palms, my heart rate was up, I was in a state of sort of shock from it, and it had physiological effects, which I sort of paid very close attention to. The next day, I was in a white escort van driving home with my friend from the surf, coming in the opposite direction towards this roundabout. We were young, we were driving the car at high speed, he had the front wheel of the car in the gutter as he was pulling the corner. And the way the garden had done had been made on the side of the traffic island, that it suddenly ended in a little cutoff, and this would have jacked the car onto my side during this corner, which would have put me onto the road and into the gutter on the opposite side. And as we approached the situation, I could feel it coming back out of me, and I just looked at him with a look of dread, really, of like, wow, look at what we're about to do. And he turned and saw that, and it caused him to flinch, and we put the car up on two wheels to almost, you know, just get around doing this, and we just missed it by like half a second.
Wow. And
that was the first time I learned to pay really close attention to it. Another one that was really profound was I was working for Greenpeace in a magazine, for the magazine, and they showed me 2 days of footage of the destruction or the pollution of the world. And this led me to an experience later that was truly profound. It was not something I expected, but I basically came out of the water at the surf one day, and the sky was reflected on the wet sand, and I walked into a focal point of this image. And the sun at sunset turned into a vast tunnel of light that was streaming creational intelligence. And I basically had my first experience with what you would call God. It was really patronizing. It sort of straightened me up and said, do you honestly think that you can destroy this? This is creation. Like, you guys might be destroying your little part of the game, but it then showed me a picture of soil, like an archaeological site where you have different layers of soil. And it said, well, the human will destroy and pollute its little layer in the soil, but it'll just be one of the layers and creation will continue on forever. Don't worry about this. And it really changed my view. You know, I also walked through that experience and stood in the car park chewing on the corner of the towel for about 10 minutes thinking, like, how many people get to see these sort of experiences? But I was at a very crucial point in my life of deciding whether I was going to work for humanity or against humanity, to be honest, because everything I loved was being destroyed by our society at this time. So that was one of the experiences. I had experiences with friends that were killed and then had them come and see me afterwards. I had experiences with gradually and slowly with different things that broke me into or out of, really, the headspace I'd been conditioned into as a child. You know, it's just a normal sort of Western domestic child. So I knew that there was a great depth to an area that whenever I drove past it, called Currumbin Valley, which is a very natural rainforest area. And every time, my family were very international, and we traveled a lot, we flew by plane a lot, and we have to drive past this spot to get to the airport. And every time we drove past it, I would look out to this area and just feel it. And eventually I got to move out there and live in my uncle's cabin out there. And that was the beginning of truly getting a grasp on understanding nature and my connection. So when I got to a point where something could have happened really related to the ETs, the first time I was confronted with the ETs, when somebody who understands nature, the nature of life and the planet you're on, they know more about that than you do, you suddenly realize you are the alien. You're actually the one who's alienated from the system that you're a part of. And that was quite confronting in the beginning. So nature's connection to all of this is vital in understanding your context within the greater picture. So that's sort of been a process that's grown all the way along and continues very much today. To be honest, you know, I honestly thought that, you know, my grandmother had a really great UFO experience when I was very young in the area that we grew up in Main Beach, and it was in the local paper, and a lot of people saw this UFO that turned up, and I was always very open to it and being on that side. And my uncle came from Asia, and he was very open to ghosts, and that these guys were very utilitarian oil field workers, and yet they all had stories of seeing things around oil rigs and you know, quite interesting perspective. So I was open to it, but I thought that maybe we'd be little old men. I'd be able to point to you out on the horizon at a little dot dancing around, and I'd say to you, I've got a pretty good idea what that is. And that's as much as I ever thought I'd get from this field. So it's been a fairly good ride. The beauty of remote viewing enabled a consistent platform to be accountable with your progress, and it enabled a secure foot, like a singular spot, to be able to explore different phenomena and come back to it and integrate it back into a whole. So that's been the real benefit of remote viewing throughout the process, is taking scientific notes, being able to review your notes. It's always surprising to review your notes and get more from it than what you did in the first experience. That's an important part. You know, you're sometimes so busy taking the details, you don't actually see what the bigger picture was. So that's a part of it as well. So
how would you differentiate or perhaps quantify the difference between clairvoyance, this old term, with remote viewing? Is clairvoyance to you more of an all-encompassing aspect of our human experience, or how would you describe that vis-a-vis remote viewing?
Yeah, that's a very good point. This is the thing, how the military came about with it. We hear in our circles the term the sixth sense, and I've definitely learned that it's not the sixth sense at all. It's actually the first sense.
Ooh, yeah.
If you look at a nerve cell, a single nerve cell, and you'll see it reaching out with little tendrils, all five senses are based on touch. Light is, eyes are touching light, sound is touching ears. Everything is about touching the environment and getting a different sense for it. It's the intent to touch, which is what's most important. You need a driving force for it. So the military, SRI in particular, Stanford Research Institute and the Monroe Institute, did a lot of work where they understood that you can, and the example that was eventually derived was that you could have a patient who's brain dead, who's laying in intensive care, and they will take a pin and they'll put that pin in the patient's toe, and they'll have a brain net on, an EEG, firing up through the spinal cord and into the brain, but there's no activity within the brain, and if there's no activity, you're considered brain dead. And that's the key point to all of this. There's no point to having senses unless you have got something to do with those senses, or you're seeking, or you're computing with those senses. So in history, when we walked through environments that were very challenging, we face the large ambush predators, and this is, if the human being's been evolving for 300,000 years, we still had very large predators in Australia 15,000 or 12,000 years ago. So, we literally had goannas the size of buses that were walking around. So, if your alarm bells rung, you want to pay close attention to them. Like if you were walking to the creek and there was a whole bunch of bushes there, and then your hair stood up, or someone in your group's hair stood up, you risk or ignore that at your peril, which
yes.
is the way to sort of put it. So the military came, like guys like Joe McMonagle is a perfect example of this. He was in Vietnam. They would put him on point. And I learned this from my own family. There are certain men that when the situation turns bad, you want to be standing next to, because he's the only one that will come out of it. And so if everybody learned in the platoon, if Joe's hair stood on end, or he wasn't happy about something, or he sensed something, you want to pay attention to that. There's a lot of other cases for it too. There's a very interesting example of in World War I, there was a German soldier that was recorded by his seniors. This is a report you can look up, of being in a bunker. And he suddenly woke up and ran out into the battlefield screaming. And a couple of moments later, the bunker was struck by a shell and destroyed, and that was Adolf Hitler. So there's examples of men that were trapped beyond the enemy lines, out in bunkers, in craters, sorry. And the person in the crater getting up, screaming and running to another crater and doing this for 8 hours straight, where everyone who couldn't get to him are just watching him change hole. Every time he changed hole, his former hole would be struck and blown up. So these systems are definitely within us. The native cultures still are connected to these sorts of instincts and can communicate over distances. So things like telepathy are natural and are all sort of byproducts of it. So clairvoyance, I see, is just our non-domesticated version of sensing the environment. In the same way we tone down dogs, you know, we tone their senses down, we tone their need to run every day down, and we domesticate them so that they can be complacent within a system. Ironically, the same thing happens to men. You know, when we, you know, most of us within society don't collect our water or grow our food or create our equipment or technology or clothing, like nothing really that constitutes our existence we take care of. We are a part of a bigger system doing that. So once you return to the wild a little bit, and the threat of death is the best way of getting this to come out in you, and you know, it's one of those things. So, you know, I grew up around a hospital. My mother was head of administration in a hospital, and I had access to all the areas, and I heard a lot of experiences over the years of people having near-death experience and that consciousness was able to be outside of the body and things. So I knew that there was more to the system, and with my own experiences. So the tendency with clairvoyance is when people find out you're a clairvoyant, they say, oh, can you do a reading for me straight away? Mm. And there are people among us who are very empathetic to others and want to function in that way. And a lot of women are very good at this, you know. And I've used a lot of these women for my own training and help. But I'm not that sort of clairvoyant. I'm an explorer. I use clairvoyance to explore my system and explore nature. So, you know, you'll hear people do Ouija boards and things like this. And, you know, my question was, well, where are you? You know, what are you doing? What is there God? You know, ask these questions. These are the spice of life to me. So so some people are clairaudient and hear words. Some people are clairvoyant, which is French for clear seer, and see very visual things. And Nostradamus is a good example of a clairvoyant. So I'm a clairvoyant. I see things very visually. I occasionally hear things. So remote viewing is a little bit like music. The whole field is a lot like music, as an example. We can sit here and play on a guitar right now, or you can go to music university and learn to read and write and play technical music in an orchestra. They're both music. You know, a didgeridoo player can never have his tones written in music, but it's still music. So clairvoyance is more akin to that side of the perception. Remote viewing is the technical side of it, that it was designed to be utilitarian. It was designed by the intelligence service to derive information. So both have their advantages and both have their limitations. Using the soul to choose whether you want to kill someone or not, like what they did in the military, will produce its own limitations, and hence the group seem to suffer accordingly, so to speak. It's a quantum feedback system. What you put out, you get back. You know, the Indians call it karma, you know, the Asians call it karma. A physicist now, culture might call it quantum synchronistic environment response, back system. So advanced clairvoyance, and each clairvoyant field is a specialist in its own field. Mediumship is a very good example of really advanced clairvoyance to the source. And natural mediums who do this just do that one trip up and down all the time, and they're very, very good at it. I learned mediumship as a byproduct of going up and down the tunnel enough times that I learned the way. And as a byproduct, I could go and see people up there and see people here. So that's where I'm sort of different in that sense. I try and use the best clairvoyance I can find in the world to calibrate my work. Am I delusional? Am I self-orientated? Am I, you know, anything that could be used as a calibrating tool to correct your path? And the more correct you are, the more you appreciate being told when you are incorrect, because it gives you the opportunity to put yourself back on the track. And correct answers and correct responses or getting a target, as we would say in remote viewing correctly, is its own reward. So you constantly want to feed back how to do it. We all do that, you know, that's how we can develop. So I'd sort of explain clairvoyance as music.
Now, it's often been said by some of the founders of remote viewing that one doesn't need an outward ability in psychic abilities, for example, that it's said that your average person can learn how to remote view with some degree of effectiveness. Is that true?
Absolutely, yeah. It's inherent within all of us, this process. It's stemming from consciousness. Consciousness is inherent within each person. I have friends who are very great musicians that I will never be. I am not a musician. I cannot play music very well. Clairvoyance or art or any other field is exactly the same. We can all do it a bit. Whether you're very good at it or not, it will depend on other factors, you know. And some people are very good at it, and this is their gig. They'll never play music. And that's a bit the way it goes. So, yeah, absolutely. It is related to our consciousness. Consciousness is an expandable, learnable system. I think the Indians are very good at showing that, where the whole culture learns to be able to meditate and to be able to have internal centering and focus. So, depending on your culture is whether you'll develop it or not, has more, and whether your support system around you is helpful. If everybody's telling you you're crazy, you're obviously not going to, you know, develop as far as what you could in a greater context. If you're within the Indian context and it's very mystical, you may be lost within it again as well. So, everybody inherently does it. It's based on your soul, using your soul. The more you develop an understanding of your soul, the more you reach a stage of advanced physicality called soul attainment. And we can get more to that later.
Yes. What are the initial stages, if you will, that someone who's going through the remote view training, what are some of the things they need to do? I mean, there's some idea that one needs to be able to clear their mind, shut down the internal dialogue, as Carlos Castaneda talks about it, or be able to, I wouldn't say create a blank slate, if you will, but at least create a template through which, you know, visual imagery, mental imagery, psychic imagery, whatever the case may be, can manifest. How would you describe that process in the initial stages?
For me, the Munro Institute has a system of audio tapes and a course called the Gateway Experience. And this is a method of guided transcendental meditation, essentially. They use binaural beats, which are different tones in each ear. And this creates a harmonic within your mind, which they call hemisync or hemispheric synchronization. They have different layers or different depths of relaxation. They call them focus 10, focus 12, right up to focus 20. And the 10-step process is essentially putting your body to sleep so that you can learn to shut your entire body down, become 100% intellectual thought within your mind, and enter the dream state, essentially what is the same place of a dream. You learn to lay yourself down on a bed. You focus systematically from your toes all the way to your head, including the muscles of your eyes, your jaw, everything. A very complete system. And then from there, you are left literally with just your thought. And from there, you can begin to become familiar with accessing the thought. For me, in the beginning, I had very active dreamscape. I could fly out of body on most nights and did it just for fun. I would enter very big spaces and things. And to be able to access it consciously was really difficult in the beginning. You know, my notes on it are funny, where I'm really getting upset about it because, you know, being able to access it freely on one side but not on this side was super frustrating. Mm-hmm. But I eventually learned these processes to the point where I do them now within a split second. So they're a very good system of training. The Munro Institute is the frontier and was the original training organization for the Stanford and Defense Intelligence Stargate programs to teach people to learn how to be centered within yourself. It's funny, this is this thing with consciousness where people will say a dream isn't real, but the experience of a dream is real. Mm-hmm. And that's where you sort of start to identify internal pictures. Most of the system runs by itself, and that's a part of the mystery of it that we don't fully understand yet. So it's just accessing the system through your inherent nature. And I would definitely recommend. Courtney Brown did a lot of stuff with his work where he used transcendental meditation and sitar systems and Indian systems, and they are essentially the same thing. It's the same place that you're getting to. you know, the Monroe Institute was a less mystical based version of it. And they have that, you know, it was amazing. I finally got hold of a contact from the Monroe Institute. And at the time, this is synchronicity. This is a part of something I've seen, you know, you talk about as well, is how you see things. And at the time, a friend of mine who was a snowboard instructor, I hadn't seen in many summers. He was just doing constant winters, and he wanted to take a summer off. And he stayed with his parents in his parents' house. And I'd known him since childhood, so I didn't actually know his address, but it's Wardy's place, you know, it's his house, and you just knew how to get there. So we were hanging out all summer, and I get onto the Monroe Institute, and I said to them, do you have any contacts in Australia that I could talk to about your courses and to find out about this? They said, yeah, we've got a number for you. Here, call this doctor. He's an Israeli doctor who's our contact in Australia. And I call him, and the moment the phone starts to ring, the house opposite Michael's house, Ward's house, flashes in my mind. And this guy answers. He's out of the whole of the country in my town, and gives me his address and says, come by and have a look, and I'll show you the Institute's tapes and works, and you can have an experience. And I'm driving up the street just shaking my head going, I can't believe this. And it ended up being the exact house across the road from Michael's house.
Wow.
That was the start, yeah, of being able to get some access. So, yeah, the system works very interestingly like that, you know, where sometimes you can't stop but have it happen. Solo Taubman, his name was. He was a doctor, an Israeli doctor. He was a very good facilitator for me to have access to it. So that was part of the beginning, for sure. And a lot of that, you'll get a lot of that.
Yeah, the synchronicities and all that. And one of the benefits, as I see it, not being a remote viewer myself, but looking at things from a practical standpoint, I could see how one could utilize this capability in ways to enhance our life and ways to, you know, as long as I feel have a certain ethical grounding and stay true to self, stay true to our organic connection to source, and then we don't use it for like malicious, malign purposes, right? I believe we can derive a lot of benefit from it. And like for me, my remote viewing experiences were very much of a spontaneous nature, where I remember the very first time it happened to me, I was listening to a basketball game. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so the team I followed way back when, I don't follow basketball anymore, was the Golden State Warriors. And back then, most of it was on the radio. You know, once in a while you get TV games. And I was listening to the basketball game, and the announcer, a great basketball announcer named Bill King, who's since passed away, he described the center of the Golden State Warriors, Clifford Ray, receiving the ball beneath the rim, jumping up and doing a reverse slam dunk. And at that split second moment Bill King described that, I saw the image in my mind, right? I saw the image in my mind in real time as it happened. And what was interesting was sometime later, I'm at school, this is like year 9, year 10, in high school, and I get to know a guy named Joe, a really cool guy, a big Eagles fan, big Joe Walsh fan. We talk rock and roll all the time. And he happened to be at that game, right? I listened. It's another one of those synchronicities in which I listened to the slam dunk, reverse slam dunk, and which I simultaneously had a vision of what happened. And of all the things that Joe tells me, his memories from that game, he brings up the reverse slam dunk of Clifford Ray, of the Golden State Warriors center. So it's just one of those things where remote viewing takes place. Now, I've had a lot of precognitive dreams, and having had precognitive dreams, I learned early on that time, as we've been taught to understand it, this linear treadmill, so to speak, doesn't really exist, because, you know, where consciousness goes, I believe matter can go. And so if we can see into the future, and I've had many countless precognitive dreams in which I came to an awareness, whoa, I dreamed about this. I'm having a deja vu moment of something I dreamed about. Now, have you had like precognitive dreams, and have there been times when you found yourself in a real world situation that you dreamed about in the past?
Oh, absolutely. Every one of my girlfriends from the age of 12, I dreamt of the night before.
You dreamt about meeting them the night before.
Yeah. Especially like things like into sports carnivals where they were from a different school and you'd never seen that person before. And yet here she was the next day walking across the field. But the first one was an Asian girl that was really nice. And by 4 o'clock the next afternoon, she rang me at my home and asked me out and said, "Oh, I saw you at the thing today." And I think I was, I think that was grade four, grade five. So all of my partners have done that. I'll find that people will naturally come out of body for love. And this is a really important point that you just brought up too, is that the greatest thing to get you out in this field is to follow your excitement. The things that interest you the most will draw you out the most. You'll naturally be curious. You'll naturally want to follow that area. So I absolutely say to all people, you know, and basketball was obviously a key thing of interest to you, and it was a fun thing for you to do. Follow your fun, follow your excitement, and bam, it all just happens as a natural byproduct. Pre-thought concept happens so often that you end up just accepting it for what it is. There's some good research with the imaging where there's an experiment that they run and they'll flash random pictures up on the screen, and then every now and then they'll put instead of it being a pleasant picture, a car accident scene or something quite gory and shocking, and they can tell on the EEG machine, the electroencephalograph, that seconds before this image was shot, your nervous system spikes and then is raised in a feedback system. And if it's done randomly, the picture hasn't even been selected yet. But it's like your future self feeds back to your present self to prepare it for something that it's going to get a great shock from.
Yes.
And that's a good example of that occurring. And
it's a manifestation example of how we are quantum multidimensional beings, despite all the efforts to shunt us into this linear, you know, faux logic mode. I mean, logic has its place, but when the information that we're being indoctrinated with is bogus, manifestly bogus and fake and fraudulent, then it's like, you know, there's nothing left on the planet at that point. You're lodged into the left hemisphere of your brain, and all you know is bogus information. It's like, you know.
I'm amazed at a city when I go to a city. You know, I've lived in the rainforest for 12 or 15 years, and when I go to a city, I'm amazed at how logical it is.
Yes.
You know, you have to be up at this time. You have to go to this ferry stop to get to that part of the city. You have to go to this street, to this number, to this floor, to this desk, and you have to be onto it to be able to be there on the right time, and you have to follow it. But it's an incredibly tight and logical process to follow. Where in nature, if we were walking to the stream and we got waylaid by a tree full of fruit or something, we may spend an extra 20 minutes just enjoying that, and we will flow in a more natural time sort of frame. So, yeah, I think we are involuntarily conditioned to fit the system. And then there are manipulators within the system, like you said, that it suits them to keep you in that little sort of frame of mind. So, yeah, I tend to find, you know, city life, you try to compress your thinking into a smaller space.
Yes.
So you're not affected by everyone else. You don't want to hear the sounds at night when you go to sleep. You try to block them all off. In the rainforest, you do the complete opposite. When you lay down at night, you listen to as far as you can. You will listen to the sound of the stream. You'll listen to the trees. You'll listen to the sound of a bird at night, like an owl or something in the distance. And you can tell what is going on your property from these peripheral sounds. So in one state, you're naturally expanding your consciousness, and in the other, you're naturally limiting your consciousness. I agree with you in that sense, that one societarial pattern definitely leads to a narrowing of your focus.
And what I've heard in my studies of military history and in my studies of special ops and whatnot, well, a good example of what you described earlier, those examples from those guys in the First World War who would avoid a shelling before it came, right? Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, the legendary Desert Fox in North Africa. He was also the the commander in Normandy prior to the Normandy invasions, he was known to have the sixth sense, so-called, where time after time, he'd have his staff around him in North Africa, and his staff were going, oh no, he's going to take us on some weird foray again where we're going to have to escape the British or anyone else, because he was known to do that. But there were times when Field Marshal Rommel would say to his staff grouped around him, we have to leave now, we're about to be shelled, right? And he was the boss, they'd listen to him. So they would drive some distance away, park, and no sooner had they got there that a whole bunch of shells would land at the spot they were just at, right? And this happened again and again. It was documented, commented upon by many people. And you talked about how living in the bush heightens our senses, right? I remember this story. I've talked about it before, but it bears repeating. This U.S. Army Special Forces guy working with Montagnard tribesmen in the Vietnam War, he said that he was on this patrol. It was a mixed U.S. Special Forces Green Beret unit as well as Montagnard tribesmen. And then one of the Montagnard scouts, you know, called a halt and said, there's someone up in the trees up ahead, right? So the U.S. Army guys, they pulled out a starlight scope to enhance the available ambient starlight. Couldn't see anything. They pulled out an infrared scope to see if there was any body heat up in the trees or down at ground level. Didn't see anything. And then the Montagnard scout was getting frustrated. He said, he whispered, give me a crossbow, right? So in near darkness, pitch black darkness, right, the Montagnard tribesman fires a bolt out of the crossbow, and pretty soon someone comes falling out of the tree, right? He killed somebody with the crossbow. And then I remember watching this documentary years after the fact, and this Army Special Forces guy was just flabbergasted. He said, we looked through a starlight scope. We looked through an infrared scope. We couldn't see anything. But somehow this Montagnard tribesman knew exactly where this guy was hiding. So that's an example. And also they often talk about how for those that have been involved in jungle combat or in tropical rainforest combat, they say how silence in the jungle is a warning sign, where you could be out creeping around patrolling and suddenly all the birds, all the insects, everything goes silent. There's something going on.
That's the most alarming thing of all.
Yes. Yeah.
Silence. That's one thing with the forest. It never is quiet. If you can get 1 second of quiet, there's something quite strange. There'll always be an insect and there'll always be a bird. It's quite an interesting thing to listen to constant noise like that. I've been learning animal communication through Anna Brackenback, which is a South African animal communicator, and she has a very good documentary called The Animal Communicator.
Is she the one that talks to the panthers down there?
That's it.
It was remarkable, man. I got to post a link to that. You know.
Yeah, that's paradigm changing for most people. Yes. For sure. And in her documentary, she has all the natives where they talk about sensing the animal from a great distance and then following their heart and following even a literal white line that they see on the ground, and they track the animal through this. So they make an empathetic psychic connection to the animal that they're targeting. And the Aboriginals call it Walaja, or talking to country and country talking back. And she does an excellent example. They have a guy that she does it with called John Young, and John Young was trained by the Navajo Indian, and was raised on a reservation, and that's how they hunted. They sensed and felt more than actually just use straight line of sight type stuff. So, you know, when you've come from a domestic environment where you've never harnessed these instincts, it obviously seems very strange compared to, the guy in your example who just inherently felt that way about the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, to him, it blaring thing up ahead, but if you weren't taught to listen, you didn't hear it in that sense. So yeah, character from within us.
And one thing I've noticed,
I'm fascinated by it.
I'm fascinated by it too, and how, and I don't like to say, you know, we get back to this state in the way that animals are able to sense their their surroundings, because it's almost demeaning to animals, right? Because I believe animals have souls, and I believe that, you know, they're meant to share this world with us, you know, however dangerous it may be for any animal down, you know, down the line. But the way an animal, in our example, can immediately sense its surroundings, it's like an animal that is subject to predation. It doesn't question itself because thinking is too slow, and it recognizes the nature of the multiple threat environment in which it resides. Oh, was that a sound I heard? Is that a scent I picked up? Is something stalking me up, you know, downwind so I don't know its presence? No, the moment it detects any change in the atmosphere, energetically or otherwise, it bolts because it knows that it's, you know, it's subject to predation. And I really believe that all of this constant hammering in the form of vaccines, in the form of GMO food and chemtrailing and everything else, it's densified us, and also the lobotomizing effect, Scott, of the media, of the school system, has really kind of made us more automaton-like than anything, where we're just kind of being shunted from one place to another. Just, okay, here's another rule, here's another street, you got to make a left at, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's true. You know, there's definitely vested interest in disconnecting us from those sorts of free thought thinkings. You know, I think it's, for me, in the last couple of years, I've realized that, you know, the very first businesses were farmers, were the original farmers who had an excess of their crop and could do trade exchange. But a farmer is basically someone who hijacks another life form. And that was sort of the pretense of all business these days in the corporate agenda, is that you need to hijack an array of life forms, whether it's wheat, you know, as a plant, whether it's sheep as an animal, or whether it's human beings. And if you can keep the herd in a little group, you can use it for your own means. So, you know, the interesting thing is, even though I've been shown this a lot with my contacts lately, where they can show you that you can be lost within that system, but it's simply thought that is creating the illusion. You can't stop your physics. You can't stop the manifestation of everything. It is just a figment of your imagination that you're indoctrinated to believe. And in the same sense, a single thought can get you out of that pattern. You can start to generate your free thinking, your own instincts, your own opinions, your own integrity. It's funny how you reap what you sow. And in a lot of cases, complacency and comfort zones tend produce these limitations as a byproduct. You know? And you said before with the animals, you know, it is very is inherently made from source. And the reality that your experience here as a life may involve being predated upon is just a simple factor that you agree to when you come.
Yes.
You know, if you're an insect, you know that you may very well become a part of a bird. And that's part of the experience. If it was just sitting there and not having any threat against you, you might die of boredom.
That's right. There almost needs to be, at some level, at least in this dimension, the way it's set up, it's like stressors in the environment, which compel us to make the adjustment to continue to survive.
Yep, that's it. That's it. That's exactly it. Yeah. Pain is the great motivator, you know, and if you're comfortable, you will literally sit there your entire life without moving. It's pain that causes people and things to get up and move, and it's the movement that creates evolution to get away from the pain. And so there is a hindsight and a benefit to it all. It can teach resilience, can teach, you know, fortitude, and different things that just weren't learnable any other way. And this is a really good example of why we come to have a physical life event, is to learn things that literally aren't possible in heaven. You know, you can't have war in heaven. You don't have starvation in heaven. You don't have cold and pain and suffering. And so it's not appropriate to have it in heaven. So creation has created a place to come and have these experiences, and there's in hindsight a great deal of gratitude that comes from the opportunity to have grown through these experiences. So I've seen things through mediumship with premature babies, where you know, friends have asked, oh, you know, what has happened, why have I miscarried here, or what has happened with this? But to a soul that to never had any physicality, to have even a temporary experience within a womb as a physical entity is quite a huge experience. It involves, you know, it actually involves a bit of pain, you know, and that is to us, oh, what a tragedy, it never got to grow into a child and have a full life. Yet to that soul, those 3 or 4 months within that womb was quite an enormous experience, and it's a good precursor for them to come and have a fuller life when they can have a machine built for them, a baby or a spacesuit to come and be in. So, you know, I definitely say when there's mediumship, there's a lot of entities up in heaven or people in heaven that just don't want to come and be physical. You know, they're just like, no way, I'm not coming to go and do that. And we think we have quite an ordinary life. And yet when you go back, there's quite an array of people that look at you with a great deal of respect. And yes. Wow, look at that. Not only did you have a physical life, but you even did the full cycle where you regrew a child and you facilitated and you became mature. These are all considered very valuable experiences. So, yeah, you know, it's the same for all the animals. It's the same for all forms. It's a great big information feedback system. And I'll explain something quickly, which is a bit interesting, was that growing up around the hospital and hearing near-death experience, when I was remote viewing, I found myself in orbit one day. And this orbital position became my new home point. It was the most exciting place I'd ever seen. It was an incredible experience. But when you're surrounded by the infinity of space, it's such a volumetric shock to a normal terrestrial human that I was quite in awe of just the space all around us in every possible direction, up and down. And it seemed quite natural to follow the light. You've heard people who said, oh, well, I felt I died and I could follow the light. So from space, there's one really big light. It's the sun. And it seemed appropriate to follow the light. And the sun turned into a big tunnel and it becomes the near-death experience tunnel. And I eventually found myself at the end of that tunnel, surrounded in giant nebulous cloud and incredible streaming light and love, and it was a profound experience for someone who wasn't really prepared for it. And it just became immediately obvious that this had to be what people had been calling heaven. And the first time I was up there, I sort of tried to be very analytical about it. I tried to call it, you know, I thought maybe it's a big gravitational field and we personify it to feel better about it. And this is the only time this has ever happened, but it was like, bam, instant knocked out of the viewing, just straight back in the room, no more signal, no more nothing. And it gave me a real shock of like, well, how the hell could something like that happen? And took me a couple of days of realizing that, hang on, you do not walk up to your father or your mother and call them a sperm or egg donor.
Yes.
There is much more to it. There's love involved and there's things. So I found myself back up there on the second time and I started to look around and I realized, well, if this is what they call heaven, this must be the place that God exists. And I turned and looked into the light and there was the creator as a streaming light source and immense intelligence, and everything stopped. You know, I just stopped everything I was doing, as you do, and you will when you pass. And I just bowed my head in allowing grace, you know, loving grace sort of thing, and just sort of said, hey, thank you for giving me a life across time and including me in your creation. You know, wow. And the most incredible thing happened where it returned with a reverse simplicity thanks and just said, no, of course, thank you for going. Don't you understand that you're more than an inanimate object? You are an agent of consciousness. And we both just basically stood there smiling in this lighthearted, wow, that was cool. And that actually cleared me for being up there. So I left that meeting and went down to a group of people that were coming into the area, and there was another group of people welcoming them into this area that was up there. And I came into it from the side, which got some strange looks from the people doing the welcoming. They were like, up and said, hey, I'm here informally. I'm just here checking this out.
Yeah.
What you would call an angel.
I'm just looking, you know.
Yeah, that's it. Hey, I'm not. I don't want to do this full time, if that's okay. So what you would call an angel, a very tall, ethereal, beautiful being, came and saw me and sort of cut me off from seeing that crew, and we held hands together. And I said, "Is it okay that I'm here?" And they said, "Oh, we consider this very special. It's usually us that have to come down to see you guys. For you to come and see us is considered very cool, and we think that's great." And I said, "Well," I sort of got a bit cheeky in a sense, and I said, well, show me something. Show me something that's here." And I would say it was feminine, this being. And she reached over my shoulder and pointed, you know, and I looked down the point and out from the light. Now, light is polarized. So when we look into the light, we're like on stage looking at a spotlight.
Yeah.
When you're in heaven, you look down the light and everything is illuminated naturally, like from within a car, you know, or from within the crowd looking at the people on stage. And I was looking down the light, and out in the very far distance in the dark was this little blue spot, and I could sort of zoom in on it a little bit, and I realized that was Earth, and I went, "Oh, that's Earth." And within a second she fired me back home and I was back on the couch. I went, "Ah," you know, had really interesting experience. And that was how I got authorized, in a sense, to be able to go up. But it is such an immense feeling up there that you have to sort of put your hand over your heart to stop that feeling of love, because down here on Earth you may never feel that level of love, and the contrast between the two states can be a bit shocking, you know. So when we come, we have many different forms of love that we experience here. You love your daughter, you love your wife, you love your parents, you love sports. There's things that you love, and these are like little incremental versions of love, where in heaven you experience the love of source, which is the whole love, and it's a volumetric thing that is beyond normal comprehension. So that's where true enlightenment comes from. I was lucky enough to attain transcendental love a few years ago, and spent 3 weeks in transcendental love, and that's a profound experience, to have love streaming out of the sky and out of the land, and the most in love you've ever been with anything, but it's coming from the whole universe at once. So those different types of love experience are what we come to have, you know, are the bread and butter of the experience, so to speak. The pain is a part of it, and the love is a great big part of it.
And that's what we can't lose sight of. I've told the story again. I won't go into detail, but when my little tour guide years ago, when he pushed my hands together in an attitude of prayer in front of my heart center, and then from out of my heart center was an explosion of like pink and amber and bright light, and it felt like all this concentrated love within me, for lack of a better term, just burst out, almost like kind of in a euphoric, I don't want to say orgasmic fashion, but almost like a euphoric kind of all-encompassing transcendental experience. And then, you know, it just shows you how much I was still lodged into Mr. Spock, the Mr. Spock side of my brain back then. It was like, it was a head scratcher for me. It was like, I didn't realize I had all this love in my chest. You know, I mean, it didn't compute at the time. It was only later when I heard people talk about heart center, heart chakra, or connection to organic source. You know, it's like, it took a while for the coin to drop, right? But the object lesson that I took away from that was
beautiful experience.
Yeah, that was that we have it within us, and the system. And one point I want to make about the system is, it's not the system's responsibility to wake us up, to enlighten us, to make us recognize that we're kind of subject in a huge state of predation, right? It's not their responsibility. It's our responsibility to recognize the nature of this multiple threat environment, do what we can, love on others, uplift others, and, you know, mass prison breakout at some point, I don't know. But it's like, you know, to rail and be mad at the system, that's like a little insect getting mad at a spider. How dare you? I feel so oppressed. It's like there's a certain nature of things, mm-hmm. right? And just because at this moment we may be, you know, holding the short end of the stick, it doesn't mean things have to stay that way. And when we talk about this connection to organic love and source, and then when I think about it, that experience where this all-encompassing, transcendent love just burst out of my heart center. It had to come from somewhere. I know the ultimate source was not my heart center. It came from somewhere beyond that, right? But that was an object lesson that held me in good stead, you know, for many years thereafter, and still does to this day, that I know that I'm not forsaken. I know that I am worthy. I know that, you know, all the feelings of guilt and shame and everything, which the system teaches me to take on the shame-based wounded inner child persona, that I know that that's not the real me, that the real me is something organic and I have a constant connection to. Well, we've reached the end of a fascinating first half, and we'll have all of Scott Torrance's website information on our dedicated YouTube channel, as well as our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com. Scott's got a whole lot more to share in the first half, or the first part, rather, of the second half. I'd like him to tell us a little bit, just to, you know, tee up the listeners and viewers as to what's coming down the pike. Tell us a little bit about his initial stages and forays into remote viewing as he learned the process, you know, and how he learned to incorporate that into his life. And then after that, you know, if it's okay with you, Scott, I'd love you to talk about the ET connection, the Sasquatch experience, et cetera.
Absolutely.
So you've been watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. If you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.